So I'm going to talk about non-geometric heterotic compactification. This is work with Jacques Mekoris and Saab Seki, which is 0905, nothing. And in progress, there's a follow-up with Andreas Valmentier. So Saab gave a talk here a couple of weeks ago. He mentioned this paper that he and Jacques and I are writing at the beginning of the talk, and he said 0904. But he never got to say a word about this paper, so I'm going to talk about the work that we've been doing together. So the idea of compactifying string theory has been with us since the days when people first started thinking about string theory as a potential model for the universe. And the distinction between geometric and non-geometric compactifications has been around nearly that long. So if I have 10-dimensional string theory, or 11-dimensional M theory, and I want to couple it to something which will yield an effective four-dimensional theory. Well, if I'm thinking in supergravity terms, then the obvious way to do this coupling is to take my space-time manifold and write it as Minkowski space. Write it as Minkowski space crossed with some internal manifold. That's the notion of geometric compactification. And in the pre-1995 days, when all we were doing was perturbative string theory, the corresponding conformal field theory construction was to look at two-dimensional signal models with target Y6. And of course, depending on which of the string theories you're doing, you have to put in data that's not totally geometric in there. You have to include things like B fields, which are not the traditional things that a geometer might have included in a sigma model, but nevertheless, they have a a role to play both from the point of view of a sort of supergravity approximation, a space-time formulation, as well as a world sheet formulation in terms of a 2D sigma model. But it's also true that in the perturbative string era, there were a number of other constructions, minimal models, various orbifolds, asymmetric orbifold constructions, and so on, which from the point of view of producing a perturbative string theory could equally well be coupled to a flat Minkowski space to produce an effective theory, even though one didn't have a supergravity description, a purely geometric description of those models. So these are the geometric compactifications, and any other scheme that you might have which doesn't work so well in that supergravity regime can be thought of as a non-geometric compactification. After 1995, the situation changed a little bit, because after 1995, we had in our new non-perturbative understanding of string theory, we had ways of extending these to the non-perturbative regime. So there were non-perturbative extensions available for these. But non-perturbative extensions had generally been quite hard to come by for the perturbative constructions of conformal field theories that were not geometric in nature. And so they can still be studied and looked at from a perturbative point of view, but they haven't been so valuable in thinking about non-perturbative aspects of string theory. On the other hand, also starting after the after 95, we had some additional types of constructions that were available. We had a new tool, which was duality. And some of the dualities are geometric in nature, or sort of classical dualities. Perturbative dualities may be regarded as somewhat geometric in nature in some cases, but there are also non-perturbative dualities, which typically have, well, which typically involve things that go beyond geometry. So let me just mention as an example, if we take, well, just to stick with reality for a minute, if I take Y6 to be K3 cross T2, I could really just do this with K3 and only partial compactification of string theory, then the moduli space for these compactifications, the moduli space consists of course, it's metrics and B fields, and let me take 2A for definiteness. The moduli space is metrics and B fields, of course. But when you take the identification that's involved, so in this particular case, if I include the T2 factor, it's 0622. Those 0622 Z, those 0622 Z transformations take us quite far from the supergravity limit, and in particular, they identify points, so we get identifications of points which are somehow close to large volume with points that are actually far away from large volume. And on the other hand, the supergravity approximation is probably only valid in some relatively small region of large volume. So we get other kinds of effects to describe the physics of those other points in the moduli space, which are not easily accessible directly from geometric analyses. So here we sort of understand the geometry, here we don't. Just to make the point a little more clear, if I take just compactification on K3, so that the duality group is 0420, that 0420Z is really the symmetry group of the total cohomology of K3 with integer coefficients. That total cohomology includes an H0, an H2, and an H4. The part that's clearly related to geometric data like the metric and even the B field is the part that comes from H2, and that part involves 0319 only. So that's the part that we can recognize by the metric. But there are lots of interesting transformations, often described as mirror symmetry transformations of K3, which are involved in this larger space and which mix up the geometric second cohomology with the zeroth and fourth cohomologies, and therefore are sort of inherently non-geometric in nature. Okay, so a very useful idea. Once one had these non-perturbative dualities, was to try to take a known duality and to use it as what's often called a fiberwise duality. So what that means is that the space that I'm looking at will have some kind of fibration structure over some kind of base. I'm not going to say what the dimension is. And there's some fibers of this map, so pi inverse of S is something which is dual, say, excuse me, that's little s, is dual to some other space, let me call it Z sub S. So what you could hope to do is use the data that we could describe that assembles those fibers, those individual pi inverse of S's, into the total space X to somehow assemble, in the same way, these Z sub S's into a big space Z, and then hope that X6 would be dual, in some sense, to the Z. Now, these dualities may involve a change of string theory. In fact, they may involve a duality between the string theory and M theory in some cases, and so even the dimension may change of the objects being discussed in the duality. This general idea has been applied a number of times, and it's successful sometimes, and it's not successful other times. And I want to describe sort of improved success of applying one of the standard dualities, which I'll eventually get to, the F-theory heterotic duality, in a fiberwise context to achieve some new understanding of a class of non-geometric heterotic compactifications. Okay, so the first...
Are you going to say what fails? I mean, we understand sort of intuitively why this doesn't always work.
I will give some indications of what some of the problems are. I don't know which of them is fatal, but I do know what some of the problems are that you encounter when trying to apply fibrillized duality. So the first case that I want to try to do this for is F-theory, a by now rather old construction. So F-theory starts from a duality between M-theory on a 2 torus and the type 2B string on a circle. So as I mentioned, if the duality particularly involves M-theory, then you may end up changing the dimension in situations like this. If you, like we were in the early days of duality, are nervous about this, you can always push it down a dimension and talk about 2A on T3 being compared with 2B on T2 or something like that. Excuse me, 2A on T2 compared with 2B on T2, that's just the standard T-duality. Right, and this is derived from it. I actually, to make sense of this, need to talk about M-theory. So this was a calculation which was done in the summer of 95 by Aspinwall and Schwartz, in which the tau parameter of the metric on the T2 was related to the complexified 2B coupling on this side, and in which the area of the T2, the remaining, so a metric on T2, a flat metric on T2 is completely determined by an area which measures the total volume together with a complex structure, and that was identified with an appropriate power of the length of the circle. So anyway, some fixed power minus, I forgot to look it up, which is why I'm not writing it down. So let me not even guess. In such a way that the small volume limit of the T2 corresponded to the large circle limit of the 2B compactification. So in particular, alpha is a negative exponent. So how are we going to use this to derive a fiberwise duality? Well, the most naive thing that you could try is to say the set of possible taus, of course we have to consider them mod SL2Z, that corresponds to what's known as the J invariant of the elliptic curve. In fact, the J invariant has the nice property that it classifies the isomorphism classes of complex structures on a 2 torus. And so you might hope that you could somehow take a family. So now I've got a family X over S with fiber being T2. And you might hope that you could take J as a function of the points on the base and use the data of J to simply determine a 2B compactification with J of the 2B coupling equal the given J function. So this doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is that although the J function is perfectly good at telling when two elliptic curves are different from each other, it doesn't behave well in families. So for fiberwise duality, we need something better than just a parameter space for the objects in question. We need a way of knowing which objects, if you didn't hear, I'm not Nima. We were making jokes about that earlier. Not that it's funny. If you take this naive thing, it doesn't work because it doesn't work in families. What does work, and what's the sort of mathematical fact that makes F theory go, is that if you have a family like this, well, actually there are two steps to the fact. If you have a family, then you could replace it with a very similar family that admits what's called a section. So there's a map going the other way around. So there's a canonical way of going from one of these to one of these, and this particular construction has pi tilde inverse of S and pi inverse of S isomorphic to each other, so I haven't changed the fiber type in any way. And then once I've got the section, I can actually write it as an equation, not just an equation involving one parameter, the J invariant, but an equation involving two parameters. So it can always be written in this form, y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g, where f and g are now, well, locally they're functions on the base, and a little more globally they're sections of line bundles on S.
The subtlety is something that just completely went over my head. Maybe I should just let it, but I'm not sure what it means that J doesn't act nicely on families. You just, I mean.
So what I mean is that I can have two families that are not isomorphic as families, but
what is family?
It's just a fiber space like this. So some space that maps to another space whose fibers are the elliptic curves. I can have two families which are fiber by fiber isomorphic, but the families themselves are not isomorphic. Okay? So
that same J different F and G?
So J is determined from F and G, but so if F and G were just constants, I'd be able to completely determine things by J, but if they're not constants, then I'm not allowed to do that. So what's the ambiguity here? The ambiguity is a scaling ambiguity. I can take F and G to lambda to the fourth F, lambda to the sixth G. That's the remaining ambiguity. And so you would think all you have to do is take the invariant combination of those, and the invariant combination, J, if we normalize it the way it's usually done, is 4F cubed divided by 4F cubed plus 27G squared, all multiplied by 1728 for some strange reason. So you would think that that was equivalent information. The point, though, is that if you're in families, the lambda that you might want to take would also be a function on the base. As a function on the base, it might have zeros, and it's exactly when it has the zeros that you run into problems. So it's actually remarkable that we can reduce all the way down to two coefficients, two unknown functions on the base. They're determining the isomorphism type up to the scaling relation, but we actually get a lot of mileage, a lot of physics. The physics of F-theory, which comes out of the mathematics of elliptic vibrations, is only possible because we don't have such a rigid structure. We still have this flexibility. Okay.
Over in M-theory, do they need this? In the original M-theory picture you dualize from, that people need this?
Well, in M-theory, I'm taking this total space. So in M-theory, if I wanted to write the equations for the total space, then I would be reduced to these equations. But in M-theory, I wasn't focusing so much on exactly what was the isomorphism class of the fiber. It's a sort of interesting question, but I mean, the reason that that question gets focused on here is because we wanted to use the fiber-wise duality.
Dave?
Yes?
Is there something special about this Weierstrass form, or are there other representations of elliptic curves and other projective spaces?
Okay, so let me.
Would that be okay?
So this Weierstrass form is traditional, okay? And yes, you might think of other ways of representing this data, which would be completely equivalent to this way. This is.
So the statement is all compact examples you could get. If they can be put in any of those forms, they could be put in this form too.
Yeah, modulo this question about a section. Okay, so let me just make one comment about the section in F-theory. So the real point about F-theory is that we started here and we're making the discussion here, which really gives us M-theory, F-theory duality, but then we take a limit in which the area of the T2 goes to zero, and we're really interested in the corresponding 2B picture. That's often regarded as 2B compactified on this base manifold S, together with the inclusion of appropriate seven brains to account for some of the variation that's happening in the tau. And once you've gone to that level of detail, you actually don't care which of these two elliptic vibrations it is. All you care about is what is tau as a function on the base. And this is enough information to invert and find tau. Right? So, that's the point. Yes?
Can you look at, I mean, do principal torus bundles ever make up from?
Well, if I have a principal torus bundle and I take the Jacobian fibration, I get a trivial torus bundle.
So, that's actually a geometrically very different space now on the right side.
That's right. So what I care about for the F-theory construction is, maybe I should have said it, is tau as a function on S, right? So I really don't care about the geometry as much as I care about tau as a function on S. There's a really interesting question of what happens if you take N-theory on one of these torus bundles that didn't have a section and try to take the limit to F-theory, and, you know, is there a difference between that and the one that did have a section? And the answer is that, the best answer that I know how to give has to do with large gauge transformations at infinity obstructing your ability to take a decompactification limit. So you have some circle at infinity, you're trying to decompactify, you've got a not completely trivial structure at infinity, and I think people argue about whether it makes sense to talk about the decompactification limit, whether that structure just goes away or whether it obstructs you from taking the decompactification limit. I'm talking about this S1.
But everything is compact here, you're saying, but in the large, let's think it's large something.
It's this large circle limit, right? I'm trying to so when I fiber this, I get M theory on the Calabi-Yau space equal to type 2b on some S1 cross the base, right? And now I would like to decompactify. When I decompactify, I claim that this difference didn't really matter. Either the difference obstructed the decompactification, or you got the same answer. I've had that argument with a number of people, but it doesn't matter because that's the only possible answer you could have gotten in the limit.
So you're saying you shouldn't think about duality? Finite size, then you should only think about it in the limit.
No, I'm happy to think about it at finite size. Then it's an M theory. Yeah. That's got a little more information than F theory in it. Okay, so. So in the early 1960s, Kodaira classified what happens for elliptic fibrations like this. So he had realized that if you wanted to completely understand families, that just relying on J wasn't enough. And if I write his results, where I've taken the equation in the standard form, and I calculate the discriminant. So the discriminant measures where J goes to infinity, or tau goes to I infinity, either way of thinking about it. If I measure the order of vanishing of the two coefficients together with the discriminant at a particular point in the base, so Kodaira did this when the base was a complex with a Riemann surface and was finding out what happened at points on Riemann surfaces. The same analysis works to find out what happens generically along complex submanifolds of complex codimension 1, no matter which base we were doing. But this is the result, so it's just some mechanical table. There's a little bit of ambiguity in some of these low singularities, which can occur more than once, and actually Kodaira's classification contains more information than I'm giving you in this table. But the singularity of the total space of this model is what's being written down here. And another achievement in the very early years after 95 was to identify the corresponding singularity with the non-abelian gauge group that has that Dinkin diagram. So we have this nice dictionary here, and it lets us take any one of these guys and make a local analysis of FG and delta, figure out orders of vanishing, and see what the gauge group is. The very last line says non-minimal. That's the term that's used in the mathematics literature. If the order of F is at least 6, the order of G is at least 4, and the order of delta is at least 12, then in fact you're required, if you want to resolve the singularity, to blow up the base, not just leave the base the way it was. That process of blowing up the base changes the spectrum of the physical theory, and when you encounter that, you have to think about what it means, but it generally doesn't belong on the table. So, this is, as an exercise for figuring out singularity types, that's something that if you have learned about the singularities, you can probably do in the quiet of your own home in a day or two.
But those non-minimal points occur at finite distance in the moduli space and whatever we want to be in the different
modules. We'll see those finite points, those non-minimal points show up with interesting context in a few minutes. That's the order of vanishing. So at a given point on the base, if the base is just a Riemann surface, at a given point on the base, I can just ask what order of zero does it have? And here, f and g are allowed to have any order that you like so long as the discriminant is non-vanishing. You'll notice that because of the form of the discriminant, at most one of these can be bigger than zero. Same thing here, at most one of these can be bigger than what's stated if you want the discriminant to have order exactly six. Yeah. So the seven brain interpretation is that seven brains are the zeros of delta. Well, that literally applies for the ice of one guy, so simple zeros of delta. And this also gives a prescription for how to bring seven brains together, what kind of enhanced gauge symmetry you get. And it leads to the discussion of exotic seven brains beyond the SU and SO cases, these E brains. And these brains, the type 2, 3, and 4 in the Kodaira list, also have slightly strange properties.
When you say you can have as many as you want, there's some sub-rule that these types of singularities have.
So I've taken an arbitrary elliptic vibration in writing down these rules. Now there's an additional condition. If I want the total space to be Calabi-Yau,
right, which you need not have,
right? Okay, so I want to apply this to discuss the F-theory heterotic duality, heterotic dualities, because as people tend to forget or not mention explicitly, there are two possible gauge groups for the heterotic string, namely EA cross EA semi-direct Z2 and spin 32 mod Z2. And what I'm going to worry about most for this talk is the case when all the Wilson lines are turned off. So I want to consider the heterotic strings with those properties. So what are the moduli that we would expect? And sorry, so I'll start in eight dimensions and then later do some fiberwise duality. So the beginning of the discussion is in eight dimensions. And what is it that we would expect to see as moduli? Well, all that's left as moduli with the Wilson lines turned off is the data for specifying a conformal field theory on T2. All I need for that sigma model would be a metric and a B field. And the metric, of course, can be split into the Kähler class and the complex structure, which I'll represent by the letter tau. And then, as is traditional, these two can be combined into a complex quantity, which I'll call rho. So the moduli space looks like the upper half plane mod SL2 z for the tau, an upper half plane mod SL2 z for the rho, and then maybe mod a z2, because there should be a duality that also switches tau and rho, although not one that we're able to use in our constructions at the moment, and I'll comment at the end about the role of that duality. What about on the F-theory side? So on the F-theory side, I'm going to be writing y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g. My base at the moment is going to be P1. And it turns out that in order to get the total space x to be, well, it's an elliptic vibration over P1, so I want it to be Calabi-Yau, but that means K3 in this dimension. X is K3 if and only if the degree of f is 8 and the degree of g is 12. So I'll write an equation. I'll choose some coordinate, some affine coordinate on the base P1, and avoid complicating the notation by avoiding homogenizing things. So, I'm leaving out the limit point where you go towards infinity in the xy plane, a limit point where you go towards infinity in the s line, when I introduce a coordinate s in a minute, and so on. So all I want to do is write down the condition to have two E8s. So here's the E8. And I need order 5, order at least 4, and order 10 for the discriminant at each of the points. So for my E8 plus E8 semi-direct Z2, I'm actually going to use capital Y squared equals capital X cubed plus some coefficients. And I'm going to choose a parameter in the base such that sigma equals 0 and sigma equals infinity are the location of the E8s. Well, the total degree in sigma of that coefficient F is 8. It has to have a 0 of at least order 4 at 0 and another one of at least order 4 at infinity. And that means that up to a constant, it has to be sigma to the 4th. So if I were to include infinity, like maybe with a tau, it would be sigma to the 4th, tau to the 4th. But I'm simplifying my notation by not including that. And then, let's see, I have to have a 0 of at least order 5 at 0, and a 0 of at least order 5 at infinity, and total degree 12, and that only leaves three possibilities, B sigma to the 5th, C sigma to the 6th, and D sigma to the 7th for the equation. So there it is. Now, I should say that in one of the earliest F-theory papers, Vaff and I wrote down basically the same equation, but we used some scaling to get rid of the B and the D. But just as I discussed over here, that's fine if you only care about isomorphism types, like in 8 dimensions, but if you care about families, then you have to live with the extra coefficients. So I'm going to live with all 4 of these coefficients. The spin 32 mod Z2 case.
Sure.
Yeah, so I should have written it out. So the discriminant is going to have a 10. There's going to be a tau to the 10, right? And then there's going to be some other expression, which, lucky for us, I can tell you, which is 4a cubed sigma squared. Oh, I could have even recalculated it. It's easy in this case. So it's that. So that's some degree. This one's cubed, and this one's squared. And there's a typo in my notes. That's degree 4, right? So there are 4 zeros of this guy generically located someplace on the P1, and then there's a degree 10 here and a degree 10 at infinity. So that's the 24. If you move them all together, you raise it to 12 by and raising this to 6 and 4, and you end up in this non-minimal situation. Which is going to provide moduli, right? We want moduli, and that's going to provide the tau and the rho. In fact, I have exactly, as I pointed out, by scaling, I could get rid of B and D, so I have exactly 2 essential parameters on which this depends, 2 complex parameters, and here I had 2 complex parameters.
So the type 1 prime,
sorry,
the type 1 prime, the A8 ball, and all the A points together.
In type, that's correct.
So there's some limit in the thing.
Let's see. No, sorry. In one prime, I think you still have a couple of free brains that are moving outside.
Well, if it gets fine, are they forced to be away from the walls or can you
leave? Well, here, I mean, there's some limit in this moduli space in which I can allow these things to come together, and that's, I could sort of try to trace what point that was in this space. I guess in the type 1 prime space, the corresponding moduli space is 2 real dimensional, which is there are 2 excess brains that can move around. You pinned everything else, you've got 2 EAs, and then there's 2 more to move around. So you could sort of imagine trying to force it. When you do it, you go to some limit point in the moduli space, not part of the space that you were originally looking at.
You'd expect to be able to move the other brains on top of your E8 stack because their monogamy should commute with the monogamy of the E8 total.
Not necessarily.
If I think of the K3 as 2 DP8s.
Yeah, but it's not.
2 DP9s.
That's a degenerate limit. So there's a degenerate limit in which it splits into 2 DP9s, and that's actually a limit that's achieved by shoving the extra brains to one side. That's a limit in which on the heterotic side something has degenerated. In fact, I guess, if I remember correctly, that limit on the heterotic side is rho goes to I infinity. And so, great, that's a limit we can study. That's a good limit for studying geometric compactifications, but it's not the limit I want to study today. Let me just say about allowed. So the physics changes if you actually go all the way to the limit. I mean, there's really a difference between large radius and infinite radius. And if you're at large radius but not infinite radius, then they're close but not quite on. And it's when you get to infinite radius, the physics has changed somehow. This table is about elliptic vibrations. It's allowed on the table. It just comes in this non-minimal thing. And as I said, we have to think about what it means for the physics if we ever get to the non-minimal line.
Sorry,
just
a good thing.
Yeah.
Is your GNF interchange there?
Yeah.
New of G, new of F.
Oh.
So if you have F cubed plus P squared there, F is never competing with G. So I think you're new about the new G representation.
Yeah.
Thank you for paying attention.
That makes a lot more sense.
Okay. Spin 32 mod Z2. So the mod Z2 turns out to mean, so this case was worked out by Aspinwall, I should say, many years ago. The mod Z2 means that there is a linear factor in the equation. So it means you can write this as x minus alpha times x squared plus alpha x plus beta in some form. Well, linear factor in the equation means that there's a point of order 2 on the elliptic curve, which is completely independent of the parameter. And you need that extra point to give something other than the simply connected gauge group. So it's also a little trickier to analyze that this case. I want I12 star, as it happens. And for I12 star, what I want is to insist that the orders of F and G be not too big, but that the discriminant be pretty large. And so it's a little trickier to analyze. So rather than try to go through I was able to do this one for you, but rather than try to go through it, let me just tell you what the answer is. The answer is that y squared is x cubed plus p of s x squared plus epsilon x. So I'm actually not using the f and g form because it's easier to see the factorization if you've done it this way. P of s is degree 3. And this time I'm using lowercase x and y, and I'm using s as the parameter on p1. And this is just a constant, so this really means epsilon s to the 0. So epsilon is a constant, or degree epsilon equals 0, I should say. The discriminant is minus epsilon squared times P of S squared minus 4 epsilon. Hey, Joe, is this a pedagogical lecture? I'm going slow enough that it must be. Okay.
I have another question.
Yes.
So you said there are opposite degree A and G of degree 12.
Yes.
So I mean, suppose you wanted to be as pathological as you could in terms of singularities. Could you take F to be sigma to the 8th and G to be sigma to the 12th? Or at what point do you really move off to infinite distance in your moduli space and you're not allowed to consider the sort of non-minimal singularities that are that bad? Is there some obvious answer to that question?
No, I mean, you can also ask the question, why couldn't I consider other degrees other than 8 and 12? And the answer would...
Changing the base, you could, sure.
Pardon?
By changing the base, you, of course, could. Or by making
the total space not Calabi-Yau, right? So I think if the singularity becomes too bad, then you're going to have a hard time interpreting it in this context. And so I don't have an immediate, off the top of my head, answer to 8 and 12.
Okay, but what you're saying is there's no known place where the singularities are so bad that they've moved off to infinite distance. We just shouldn't ask the question.
Well, the non-minimal ones really are... In eight dimensions, the non-minimal ones really are at infinite distance. I was pointing out that it really meant, in some sense, that you took the radius on the hadronic side completely to infinity, and that's an infinite distance from the moduli of the compactified guy.
And there's no qualitatively worse behavior than something being at infinite distance as you approach it. I'm basically asking whether something could be even worse than your 6 and 4.
Well, let me defer the question again, because if I have a multi-parameter base, then worse could mean something different.
Okay.
Okay. So now I would like to do fiber-wise duality, and rather than try to do... Oh, I should point out that shortly after Vaff and I wrote down this family with the B and the D equal to 1, a large group of people whose names I will say accurately since I'm being recorded, Lopez Cardozo, Curiel, Lustig, and Mohapt, calculated J of tau and J of rho, although all they were able to get were the symmetric combinations, which actually makes sense in light of the tau goes to rho exchange symmetry on the hadronic side, as nice algebraic functions of A and B. So the versions of those formulas are important to me, but I need a different variant of it, so I'll withhold telling you what the formulas were. And analogous formulas were calculated in this case, J of tau plus J of rho, and the product by Klinger and Duran much more recently. So that was a 1996 calculation. This was a 2000-something or other calculation. Okay, so I want to do these in families. And to do these in families, now I wanted to think about on the hadronic side, spaces which are elliptically fibered, and try to use the fiber-wise duality with the Wilson line moduli all turned off. The way I'm going to say that is that the gauge group is unbroken. The original heterotic gauge group is unbroken. And on the F-theory side, I would like to fiber these same models. And just as in the elliptic curve case, I have to use extra parameters. So this, by the way, P of S, right, has P0S cubed plus P1S squared plus P2S plus P3. So there are a total of 5 coefficients to worry about here. There are 4 in the other example. And I'm sort of stuck with them. I mean, there are various changes of coordinates and scalings that I could do to get rid of some of them, but those changes of coordinates and scalings might not work if I've got everything depending on parameters. So I just use the same forms with the one exception that my base now, S, so I had my X over S, but now my S is going to be itself a P1 bundle, projectivization of some rank 2 vector bundle over some other space B. So that's just a fancy way of saying that S has a nice map to B, with fibers all being P1, and it's known in that case that the data for such a thing is determined by the choice of a single line bundle. And then in this case, A is a section of minus 4KB. B is a section of minus 6KB plus L. C is a section of minus 6KB. And D is a section of minus 6KB minus L. So that's the completely general story. And I can do similar things here. P will be a section of minus 2KL, minus 2KB minus L. Well, let's say PJ plus 1 minus JL. And then epsilon is a section of minus 4KB plus 4L. So those conditions are simply to guarantee that the total space is Calabi-Yau, whatever dimension I'm working in. So I get these Calabi-Yau spaces, and I have now a wide variety of examples that I can imagine constructing. So the conditions are that you don't really want all of A, B, C, D to be zero. Actually, the ones which you can argue really can't be zero if you're going to have a well-behaved model are B and D. And the existence of sections for these two guys, non-zero sections for these two guys, puts a severe constraint on the possible Bs and Ls that you might have. So for example, in six effective dimensions, so I was in 8D a minute ago, but in six effective dimensions, L has to be, so B has to be P1, L has to be one of the standard line bundles on P1, and then S is a Hertzebruch surface, F, N, absolute value N, and N is restricted in this case by the existence of those sections to lie between 12 and minus 12. So those are the only possibilities that you can have in 6D. In this case, N is actually restricted to lie between 4 and minus 2. Similar sort of analysis of which of those guys have sections. But if I go down to four dimensions, then it's not just P1, it could be Del Pezzo surfaces, you have a variety of line bundles to choose, lots of possible models that one could build in this way from the F-theory perspective. I'm going to tell you in a few minutes how to get the heterotic versions of these guys.
So if we'd chosen P2 or something, what would happen if we tried to make an E8 cross E8 singularity? You just told us we use that, the E8 cross E8, we couldn't choose P2. So what happens if we...
You couldn't choose P2?
For your...
I said Del Pezzo. P2 is a Del Pezzo.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's one of the FNs for some particular thing.
Simplest.
No, Del Pezzos could be blow-ups of P2.
Oh, I see.
Right.
So it's the FNs plus logs.
Are we talking about... Sorry, this is in 6D. The base I was talking about was P1,
yeah.
And now I had a P1 bundle over P1, which was an FN. That has to be always an FN. That's just sort of the definition of FN.
Good.
In four dimensions, I could take as a base P2, P2 blown up in 8 points, P1 cross P1, lots of different
right.
choices,
okay.
And then I've got P1 bundles over that.
Right. But so in the six-dimensional case, where you really said it was just FNs?
Yes.
What happens if you choose a different base?
I don't get a Calabi-Yau total space.
And you just...
You can get a
Calabi-Yau
from P2, it's just not
yeah.
like it's
a erotic. Right. I mean, there's no elliptic vibration over P2 that's a Calabi-Yau free ball that's elliptic.
No, this is one-dimensional.
I'm taking an elliptic vibration over a surface which has a P1 vibration. The reason that I want the surface to have a P1 vibration is that I want to apply fiberwise duality from 8 dimensions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, good. So you certainly okay. couldn't apply fiberwise duality.
If I took P2 instead of FN, I couldn't apply fiberwise duality.
Certainly, yeah.
Right.
But there was an E8 cross E8 dual for that, and one could study.
Undoubtedly. Well, on the F-theory side, remember that the F-theory models came from M-theory, and so Calabi-Yau is the right anomaly cancellation condition for F-theory as well as for M-theory.
Well, you're just choosing to study neurotic on T2 when you preserve supersymmetry.
Yeah, sorry. Of course I'm preserving supersymmetry, lots of supersymmetry.
Okay, but wait, it's not like taking flux.
I don't have, there are no flux, except for the fact that F-theory has some inherent fluxes. There are no fluxes here. let me finish my story, then we'll talk about whether I can include flux. Okay, so what I mentioned that I don't want B and D to vanish identically. The reason B and D vanishing is bad, right, is exactly here. That's what would raise this order of vanishing to 6 and get me into the non-minimal case. But there's nothing I can do to prevent it from vanishing occasionally. So typically B and D have zeros. In fact, the number of zeros of B, well, let me do in 6 dimensions again. The number of zeros of B is 12 plus n, and the number of zeros of D is 12 minus n. It's another way of seeing that n will be bounded between 12 and minus 12. And it's been traditional to assume that the duality assigns these to point-like instantons. Well, sorry, I should say two things. The first thing is that I got to non-minimal, but it didn't happen to me in codimension 1 on the base S. It happened to me in codimension 2 on the base S. And the interpretation that one has given to that in the EA Cressy 8 case is point-like instantons. And so the point-like instantons, which have to be distributed between E8 left and E8 right, I'll just arbitrarily assign one of B and D to left and right and the other to the other. And that's how I get this variety of models. So this was also a feature of what we wrote down in 96 when we were first studying these models in 6 dimensions. Here, the story is slightly more complicated. You can get strange behavior of the non-minimal type either through zeros of epsilon or through zeros of P0. The zeros of epsilon correspond to the point-like instantons in this context. The zeros of P0 correspond to some things which Aspinwall called hidden obstructors. And my main construction that I want to tell you about does not apply when there are hidden obstructors. So I'm going to assume that P0 is equal to 1, and that actually means in 6 dimensions, I'll assume that n is equal to 4. And just ignore that. Really interesting, it is an interesting issue to talk about hidden obstructors, but we can't make our main construction work in that case.
Well, can I ask another question?
Yes.
So, I mean, the interpretation of this n on the heterotic side is there are 24 instantons, and you can distribute them between the two E8s.
That's right.
In the SO32 side...
On the SO32 side, it turns out that the correct count of instanton number is the number of zeros of epsilon plus 4 times the number of zeros of P0. These hidden obstructor things are these funny things which actually came from Berkus, Lee, Schwartz, Polchinski, maybe? I can't remember who's on that paper. Some 60, interesting 60 models. Maybe not, I don't know. I think you are on that paper, Joe. Yeah, okay. So there's somebody else on the paper, too, but I'm forgetting. Oh. Well, in alphabetical order, I was getting there, right? still alphabetical, I'm okay. The interpretation was that the... So these were theories without vector structure, and that you could identify points contributing these theories without vector structure as if they were 4 point-like instantons sitting on top of an A1 singularity. That was Paul's interpretation, and that coincides with this. This is zeros of P0 with this computation for the instanton number. So I'm ignoring that phenomenon for here, and for me, there would just be 32. Okay. So the key fact that I want to base the rest of the discussion on is one that I find really ironic. So it comes from work of Klinger and Duran. Klinger was a student of John Morgan who was bothered by the lack of sufficient geometry in this eight-dimensional duality, which he became acquainted with when he was working with Friedman and Witten on some of the details of how the eight-dimensional duality works with Wilson lines turned on. And he set the student of his, Adrian Klinger, on this, and later Klinger and Duran came up with this very pretty geometric interpretation, which is ironic for me because it's based on a theorem of mine from the mid-80s, which I could have possibly thought to apply in this context, but didn't. So here's the story. If I take these eight-dimensional models, so I had my x EA cross E8, for example, which depended on the ABCD. If I take one of those guys, it turns out that there's a very geometric correspondence with a product of elliptic curves. And the geometric correspondence goes like this. There's an involution on this one. So if I take x mod the involution, there's the minus 1 involution on this one, e minus f mod minus 1, so that I get the Coomer surface. And these guys are isomorphic to each other. Moreover, when you follow it around, you end up likewise, I should say, for the spin 32 Monte 2 case. And so when you follow it around, in fact, you discover that the J invariance of E and the J invariance of F are equal to the ones that you were expecting from these older computations. They're the J of tau and the J of rho. So there's this geometric fact, and what Macoris, Sethi, and I have done is to refine it a little bit to get a better control over the mapping. So actually, these guys, again, were only doing A1, C1. They weren't doing it with an eye to the fiberwise duality. So we can do it with all A, B, C, D, and it has really interesting applications. What it's going to mean is that I can make a dictionary between geometric families of pairs of elliptic curves like this and geometric families of these eight-dimensional F-theory models. Well, the geometric families of the eight-dimensional F-theory models are just F-theory models in lower dimension, and the geometric families of the E's and the F's, well, the E's should be counting my tau, so those should be the elliptic curves in which I want to compactify. The F's carry data, if the rho is varying, the F's carry data, including a variable complexified Kähler class, so I can build non-geometric heterotic models which involve a complexified Kähler class quite directly from this geometric fact. So more specifically, I'm going to be taking a family E over this base B and a family F over this base B. So these are my two auxiliary families of elliptic curves, families of tutori. This one, I'll give equation v squared equals u cubed plus a2u plus a3. This one I'll give equation w squared equals z cubed plus b2z plus b3. I'm really running out of letters in this whole story, so I'm being very careful about how I choose the letters. I want no letter to be used twice. I don't know if I'm succeeding. Oh, rats. Here's some A's and B's. Oh, well. Can't win. And so now I'll tell you how to get the P's and the epsilon or the ABCD out of this data. So this is the sort of concrete version of the key fact. So the concrete version of the key fact says that it's easiest to say with the P's. So P0, as I said, I'm assuming is 1. Once I have P0 equal 1, by the way, I can complete the cube on P by a change of variables in S. I couldn't do that if P0 wasn't 1 because I would have to divide by P0 to do that completion of the cube. But once I have P0 equal 1, I can set P1 equal to 0. That's not a big deal. And then P2 is minus 4 A2B2. P3 is minus 27 halves A3B3, and epsilon is 1 eighth times the discriminant of the A cubic times the discriminant of the B cubic. So it's that 4 A cubed, A2 cubed plus 27 A3 squared type combination. So that's the geometric result which links these guys together. So let me just mention what the thing is I did in the mid-80s. So this is a K3 surface. This total space is the K3 surface. And it's a K3 surface that has a particular rank 16 lattice, namely E8 plus E8, contained within its second cohomology. And what I proved was that any K3 surface, it's rank 18 because it's also got the elliptic curve and the section. And what I proved in the mid-80s was that every K3 surface with rank at least 18, with Picard number at least 18, and in some cases 17, had this kind of 2-2 relationship with a complex 4 torus, which in this particular case is easily seen to be the product of two elliptic curves. So it's really just a special case of something that I had done more generally back in the days when I was nothing but a mathematician. Right, so I didn't tell you how to do it if I cared about A, B, C, and D. So for A, B, C, and D, I actually have to choose. So I have to choose a factorization epsilon equals BD. And having chosen that factorization, then A is essentially P2, and C is essentially P3. And then B and D are with those chosen things. So I can get either of these families, and which ones I get, depending on the base B, right, if we're down at four dimensions, these have to be sections of appropriate line bundles, so the line bundles would have to match up and so on. So what's the interpretation of this formula, of these formulas? Well, first let me consider the case where rho is constant. If rho is constant, then B2 and B3 are constants. This is just giving me a way of writing down the data for the F-theory dual of a given heterotic compactification. So I have a standard heterotic compactification. It's on this space script E. And the geometric data there is giving me the equation, right? Y squared equals, well, I'm not going to write it out again, but it's the equations that I've written down over there with those coefficients. So we get the explicit data for the F theory side. Now, we don't get anywhere near as many coefficients as we might have thought we were going to get from the F-theory side. We don't get all of the possible values of the coefficients, and you can see why. Basically, up to worrying about what line bundles things are sections of, I'm allowed to choose arbitrary values for these guys. If I've chosen, again, taking the B's to be constant, if I've chosen the values for A2 and A3, and I know what the values for B2 and B3 are, if I've chosen the values for P2 and P3, excuse me, and I know what the B2 and B3 values are, that's going to determine the epsilon for me. But in general, epsilon should be allowed to vary freely. And that same remark also applies to the B and the D if instead of being given epsilon, I'm given it in factored form. So it's a slight puzzle until you remember that there's additional data on this side, which is the location of the point-like instantons. And in fact, when we're doing this fiber-wise duality, if we were to have allowed a point-like instanton to occur, this is a strictly heterotic statement, if we were to have allowed a point-like instanton to occur away from singular points, or rather singular fibers of that fibration, E script E over B, then we wouldn't be able to apply the duality, that the presence of that point-like instanton actually changes the physics. That's a funny transition point, and what you're supposed to do to get good physics there is turn on an extra tensor multiplet, so you get this non-perturbative model, which has the interpretation in the Hojala-Witten description of the M-theory fibre moving away from the end of the world, right? Hopefully people remember that description. So I've got to keep those instantons away from the smooth fibres, and in fact we argue that we should actually keep the instantons away from singular points, smooth points of singular fibres. So this data, we claim, corresponds to locating the point-like instantons at the singular points of fibers of lambda.
Can't they blow up into smooth gauge bundles then inside the singular, and in the heterotic side, couldn't they blow up not into instantons in the integral, but into E8 cross E8 gauge bundles that break the E8 or something? And that would be more data on the F3 side?
I don't see why.
And they could, or you think they're obstructed from becoming smooth vector bundles?
I mean, they could always. There's always that modulus, right? So that no matter where I've put them, I've got that ability. I can break the gauge group.
Okay.
But I'm taking a case where the gauge group is unbroken, and I'm restricting to that subset of moduli, right? But even with that restriction, I didn't have enough moduli until I realized that the point-like instantons had to be located someplace.
And on the F-theory side, that set of moduli is obvious, and on the heterotic side, it's not.
Well,
the second and order.
So on the heterotic side, the moduli should be the, in this case where the b's are constant, the constant values of j, of rho rather, and the functions a2 and a3 together with the locations of the point-like instantons. But I don't know how to write those down so well. In fact, those are hypermultiplets, so they're quaternionic moduli, because actually the K3 itself is one quaternion variable in size. On the F-theory side, I'm only getting complex parameters, so I would have to use their Ramon-Ramon partners to turn them into hypermultiplets. So I really wasn't expecting to be able to find that much of a dictionary. So the claim is that they would be located there. What it does is it finds a particular class of F-theory models where we claim that not only do we know the A2 and the A3, but we know where the instantons should be put. And if you move the epsilon away from that, that means the instantons moved away, but I don't know where. I don't know how to track where they went. So how do I get the non-geometric models? Well, it should be pretty clear. It's quite analogous to models that were studied in detail by Hellerman, McGreevy, and Williams about 5 years ago. They were studying type 2A models, and they tried to combine a rho variation and a tau variation into a single model using stringy cosmic string type constructions. Here we see that happening completely naturally. So the conditions on the total space on the F-theory side being Calabi-Yau essentially allow three solutions. One solution is the one I just did, where rho is constant, and the E over B gives me a Calabi-Yau of one smaller dimension. I could have tau constant and the F over B giving me a Calabi-Yau of one smaller dimension. Or I could have rho and tau both varying, and the E over B and the F over B both being sort of half Calabi-Yau, So the clear case is where it was K3s, and what I'm talking about is DP9s. So I could have two data for DP9s. That would be, instead of degrees 8 and 12, that would be degrees 4 and 6 for each of these families. But that gives me degrees 8 and 12 as I need for the product family. The discriminant work turns out to work out. I can divide the 24 instantons between the two sides any way I want, just bearing in mind that some of those instantons are coming from the rho variation, some of them are coming from the tau variation from the heterotic perspective, but that's okay. I don't care about that. The size is measured by rho, remember?
Right.
And rho is varying. So
I know it's varying, but I'm not saying it's sort of an average rho.
It doesn't have an average. I mean,
there's an odd thing, but what I'm asking is,
If I'm here, it's small. If I'm over here, it's big, right? And if I go around here, I lost track of what the metric was because I had monodromy. So let me tell you a picture which I think is very helpful. So the picture is that I'm taking, say in the 60 case, I'm taking this K3 on which I'm doing the heterotic compactification. Now I'm going to take 12, it's not a K3, it's a DP9. So I'm going to compactify the heterotic string on this elliptically fibered rational elliptic surface, so-called DP9. And I'm going to take 12 NS5 brains. And I'm going to locate them at, so I don't know where, but probably the section. So I suppose I should have a section there. I'll locate them at the section of this point, sticking out into the effective space, and at particular points on the base, right? So those are the analogs of the 7 brains which occur in F-theory, and they cause monodromy. And if I'm too close to one of those, I have a lot of trouble telling what's going on with, well, sorry, it's the B field that I have trouble telling what's going on. Near one of those guys, the elliptic curve gets big. Away from the brains, maybe it gets small. It could do different things. Depends on which of the limit points in the upper half plane you go to. Whether you think it's big or small depends on your local reference frame for this theory, right? For example, right? Okay, so these are our non-geometric models. So we have these things, the data for these two vibrations that are half as big as before, but they also give an F-theory point. Now, in 6 dimensions, the F-theory moduli spaces that you get also contain geometric compactifications. Basically, if I've got one of these guys with the product structure, with the A's and the B's both varying, that determines what that epsilon is. But now if I reinterpret those functions as if they were only an A or only, I mean, this one is only A2 and that one's only A3, then there's a different value of epsilon for which that same P2 and P3 have been achieved. So what's the meaning of that? Well, I sort of alluded to that early in the talk when I reminded you that K3 moduli has these nice geometric places, and then it has these much more quantum places back here. That also applies if I've included, if I'm doing the heterotic compactification on K3, not just the type 2. And so what I'm essentially asserting is that I've gone back here, someplace where it's a quantum K3. That quantum K3 has an interpretation as one of these non-geometric compactifications with both rho and tau varying somehow. So there are certainly Senn limits, right? So you can sort of take a Senn limit where the rho is variable, but then becomes constant, and then there's some transition to some other branch. Yes. And then when you get down to 4 dimensions, you won't necessarily have things linked together anymore. I mean, now you'll have spaces in which you can do the split construction with both rho and tau varying, other vacua in which you can only do one or the other, and no particular reason why they would have to be connected to each other. Let me make one final comment about this construction, and that is that from the F-theory perspective, I could wrap a D3 on the P1s on the base, or maybe it's easier to understand what's going on if I look at the corresponding K3 for M theory, and if I wrap, so if I go down one dimension and wrap M5 on the K3, either of these give a way of trying to analyze the heterotic string from the F theory perspective. This is a variant of an old Harvey Strominger construction, again from the early duality days. And we believe that using this, we'll be able to say something more concrete about what the conformal field theory is that's generated by this non-geometric construction. There is no large radius limit. You can't treat it as a signal model, but because we've got this heterotic string of soliton type construction available to us, we're expecting to be able to say something about these conformal field theories, so the perturbative side of this story. This entire story, I should have pointed out, was completely perturbative on the heterotic side, right? We lost large radius, but we did not lose weak coupling.
But if there is a signal, then there is a large radius limit, right? Just like in F theory, there's a signal limit that fixed their
opposite,
then there's a weakly
coupling. Well, so the way I'm regarding a send limit is as a transition point between two different branches on the moduli.
Well, so what I had in mind was a send limit in previous incarnations of
that
theory.
So in
you guys were and they come up as a constant and variable. So is there an analyze that
here as well? But that's not on full moduli. So I think part of the point.
Well, you're saying, might be useful at the same level.
That's right.
Is there a reason your base can't be large? That you've done something with the row and count the modules.
No, the base can be, I mean, the base B of the base S. Remember I had elliptic over P1 on the F theory side, and then the P1 is fibered over B. So the size of the S is what governs in this duality the heterotic coupling. And the fact that I haven't specified anything about size of S means I could do this whole story at weak or strong heterotic coupling, right?
Don't the point like instantons make that problematic? Because you have NS5 brains sitting around at points on the base, and the string becomes strongly coupled with the NS5 brains. So they're not evident in the construction, but they're there for tadpoles.
I haven't thought about that.
On the F theory side, B is your base.
The F theory is double fibered, so yeah. it's got an elliptic fibration over S, and then S itself is fibered over B. So here the fibers are P1s, here the fibers are T2s.
Okay. Why did you not get?
Yeah.
Some elements of this sort of smell a bit like this Hull's double torus thing.
Thank you. I meant to mention that. So Hull and various collaborators have investigated a double torus formalism and have found a framework in which to discuss non-geometric convectifications, which involve using a double torus. What I would say about the relation with ours is that in this particular case, we have a very geometric way of seeing what that double torus formalism is, and it lets us be much more precise about how to make the constructions. Yeah, it's very closely related in spirit to what they've done. I should also point out that because of the limitations of that old theorem of mine, which are not just limitations in technique, the result is actually false, if you were to turn on a lot of Wilson moduli, you would lose this connection with an E cross F. However, you still retain a connection with some torus of some dimension. The dimension may grow a bit, and this is actually what Andreas and I are investigating, is how to extend this story to the presence of Wilson lines, hopefully still retain some of the geometric features so that we could understand how to make these non-geometric constructions in a broader context. So maybe I'll stop there.
More questions.